Welcome back to the Strong Gravity Seminar Series. It's great to kick off the series this fall with Ardrey Perda, who's a joint postdoc at Princeton and the CCA. But before we get started, I just wanted to remind everyone, so we have a Google Sheet sign-up sheet where you can propose speakers. So I'd just like to remind everyone of that. So please go in there and suggest speakers that you'd like to hear of. We try to cover all aspects of research that people are interested in here in the group, as well as possible. So if you want your scientific interests covered, please suggest speakers. I'll send around the email again with the link. It might be buried in your inboxes somewhere. Anyways, without much further ado, let's get started. It's 4 minutes past one. Bart, if whenever you're ready, please start sharing your slides.
Thanks, Daniel. Thanks for having me virtually. I hope to see you all in person in the future. For today, please just interrupt me if you have questions. And if I don't see it, then just speak up, or maybe Daniel can notify me, because I'm going to make your screen small so that I can see my own slides. So I'm Bart. Daniel already introduced me. I don't need to go through these administrative details. I want to tell you something about black hole flares and about the plasma physics that actually governs the flaring mechanism. So for that, first, I want to tell you a little bit, probably stuff that you already know, about the Event Horizon Telescope and what we observed. So in 2017, we observed the accretion disk of M87, and the EHT typically sees actually the accreting plasma, or actually the radiation coming from the accreting plasma. So there's strong gravitational and electromagnetic fields involved. And if you want to simulate that to understand the dynamics, then you need to use general relativistic magnetohydrodynamics, or at least that's what we typically do within the EHT. And to give you an idea of the typical length scales involved, the macroscopic size of this ring is about 10 to the 8 kilometers. It's take it as an order of magnitude estimate. And the microscopic size is maybe about a kilometer if you talk about the gyration radius of an electron or a positron. The mean free path of such an electron in the system is about 10 to the 8 Schwarzschild radii. It's much larger than the system size. Or comparable to the system size, rendering this plasma collisionless. So these plasmas typically don't, plasma particles typically don't meet any other particles, they don't interact. But this means that they can accelerate, nothing keeps them thermal. So they can accelerate out of the Maxwellian and actually start radiating very strongly. However, magnetohydrodynamics, or MHD, it treats the plasma as a fluid, which is by definition not collision. So it's in thermal equilibrium, and you assume that there are collisions to keep it such. And this means that you know typically what the ions are doing, but you don't know what the electron dynamics are, or more particularly, you don't know what the temperature of the electrons is. And those electrons are the ones that radiate. So this gives you the main uncertainty in interpreting where this radiation comes from. So this tells you that GRMHD models alone are insufficient to fully understand the EHT observations. Now, recently we had our polarization images out, and that tells us a little bit more, at least about the magnetic field. So if you look here in the left top corner, if you do a simple toy model of a magnetic field around the black hole, then you will see that depending on the orientation of the field, you get different polarization images. And the question is mainly, is this magnetic field in this accretion disk, is it weak and turbulent, or standard, as we call it, standard and normal, or is it strong and coherent, or as we call it, magnetically arrested? And it turns out, if you look at this observation here, the lines here, they indicate, if you compare to these three images, they indicate that the magnetic field is mainly vertical. And you can look at this cartoon here from Ramesh Narayan, where he says that if you have such a vertical field, that can actually impede the accretion, and he called that a magnetically arrested disk. So the magnetic field is so strong and coherent that it can halt the accretion dynamically. Sasha Chukovskoy did simulations, the first simulations of this, and here you see in a GRMHD simulation how this actually looks like. So in the blue region here, you have a jet, a north and a south jet that's ejected through the Blandford-Znaik mechanism. And here you see that vertical field in the accretion disk, and that is halting the accretion. Now, we recently did very high resolution 2D simulations, and I'll go into detail later on. But one particular feature that's important in such a magnetically arrested disk is this current sheet here. So here in the white regions, you see the same jet as you see here in blue. Here you see the disk. And at a certain point in time, this current sheet can form here. So there is anti-parallel field from the, like, separating the north and the south jet. An anti-parallel field can break and reconnect. And that happens typically in a current sheet. And in this current sheet, you see these little blobs, and there are plasmoids. And I will tell you later on why they are important. So to go to different observations, like both from Sagittarius A star and M87, we have observed flares. And for M87 particularly, we've seen very bright flares in the TeV range, so gamma ray flares, from 2005 onwards, and then about every 2 to 3 years typically. We also know that there is a concurrent radio flux coming from close to the nucleus. So we know that this emission typically originates from close to the horizon and not from the HST1 knot, for example. And the variability time scale is of the order of a few days, which tells us that the emission region has to be of the order of a Schwarzschild radius just by causality arguments. The question is now if magnetic reconnection in this current sheet can actually accelerate particles, because we know from local box simulations that reconnection of field lines is a very strong particle accelerating mechanism. I'm now questioning if this can power such a flare and if it actually happens close to the horizon. Well, I already sort of told you that it does in our 2D simulations. A second very interesting aspect are the flares from Sagittarius A star, which have been observed maybe for the past 20 years. You can see an example here on the right. They're a bit better resolved, both in time and space. And recently in 2018, the gravity interferometer actually observed an orbiting hotspot that was flaring, or that was giving like peaked emission, as you can see here in the left top corner. And here you see like the centroid motion of this flare going around the black hole. So it does about one orbit and then it's not seen anymore. The emission that gravity saw was like non-thermal in the near infrared and X-ray, and such flares occur every 6 to 24 hours, depending on what particular type they are. And we know actually that if reconnection is the origin of such a flare, reconnection also forms plasmoids, or these little blobs of plasma. And the blob, the hotspot that gravity saw orbiting, actually reminds us a lot of these plasmoids that we see. So we're wondering if we can connect not only the flare itself, but also the orbiting hotspots to the reconnection phenomenon. In this particular system, electrons are accelerated to Lorentz factors of 10 to the 6. That requires a certain magnetization of the surrounding plasma. And then these electrons emit non-thermal radiation. But also here, their gyro rate is typically 10 to the minus 11 Schwarzschild radii. And the emission region of the hotspot is about 1 Schwarzschild radii. So also here, you have an extreme scale separation. So this requires not only a lot of resolution but to resolve the physics, but even the MHD modeling itself might just not be enough. So what people have done so far, this is an example by Greg Werner, but there are other groups who have assimilated a single reconnection layer with particle and cell codes. Really of the particles or macro particles, and they solve the full Boltzmann-Vlasov equation alongside Maxwell's equation. So they really solve the fundamental equations and not the fluid equations. And what you see is that such a layer becomes unstable to the plasmoid instability or the tearing instability. And tiny plasmoids can form wherever the current sheet tears. So here in the upper region, you have the field going to the left. And here in the bottom region, you have the field going to the right. So it simply starts with anti-parallel field that reconnects. These plasmoids can then grow. They advect with the flow and they can merge into these larger structures that you see here, and they can grow more and more, and they become very hot. So they're really containers of non-thermal particles that radiate. And you see actually that this is sort of a self-similar phenomenon, because if two large plasmoids emerge, you get a new current sheet, again, because these plasmoids have like helical field, or in the 2D plane, just circular field. So the field here where they sort of touch each other is, again, anti-parallel. Right, that's a detail that's not very important for now. So how can we model this in a fluid code, actually, in an MHD code, including strong gravity and including the global dynamics that you cannot typically resolve with these fundamental particle and cell simulations? So a couple of things that you probably all know, I'm going to mention them anyway. The plasma is typically highly magnetized. That means that the magnetic enthalpy density is larger than the thermal enthalpy density. We have to deal with relativistic velocities, and also there is the non-zero Riemann tensor, there is curved space-time. So those are all things you have to take into account. And if you do that in our case, in the inviscid Navier-Stokes equations and Maxwell's equations, look something like this. So you got your typical conservation laws, and if you blend them together, then you get GRMHD. So the fluid is a source for the electrodynamics, and the electrodynamics is a source for the fluid motion. However, ideal GRMHD, which is what is most commonly used and which actually describes this kind of accreting system very well, it assumes a resistivity that is zero, or an infinite conductivity, which is a very good approximation for accretion disks for, say, 99% of the domain, but not in the current sheet. Because Alfvén's theorem tells you that the fields are frozen into the fluid and you have a vanishing electric field in this fluid frame. And you can see that that has to be true, because otherwise your drift speed, E cross B speed, would be larger than the speed of light. And this means that the electric field is a dependent variable. So it's just minus V cross B in our standard vector terms. And you need to solve the induction equation for ideal GRMHD, et cetera. But it means that in theory, at least, magnetic fields cannot reconnect. They cannot break because there is no resistivity that makes them break. It does happen in numerical codes, because there is grid-based resistivity, but we don't always know how that behaves, because it's practically just due to the non-infinite resolution that you're using. And those parallel electric fields that you don't have in ideal GRMHD, they're actually responsible for at least the initial kick that a particle gets to get out of the Maxwellian and to start radiating in such a reconnection layer. So you cannot capture that effect. So we developed a resistive GRMHD code where like the macroscopic aspects are just typically covered by MHD, as in the ideal case. We did it because we cannot capture the kinetic physics on a global scale. It's too demanding. So we actually use a resistivity as a proxy to capture a magnetic reconnection. Resistivity is typically very small, so that means you need to resolve small length scales and like fast time scales. And this requires high resolution. So we use adaptive mesh refinement. And just something I want to, you can forget it afterwards, but I want to still emphasize, is that we're actually solving now not just the induction equation, but we're solving both Ampere's and Faraday's law for the evolution of electric field and magnetic field here. And there is a resistive source term in the Ohm's law that now goes into Ampere's equation. And you see here that there is this resistivity eta here in the denominator. This means actually that, as I said already, we need to resolve fast time scales. And for that, we are using an implicit method that can overstep the typical time scales. And in that way, it allows for a very small realistic resistivity. I mean, realistic, I mean that it's small enough to capture the plasmoid instability in reconnection, but it can never be as small as you like to be in realistic systems. That's just too large scale separation for any code at the moment. And in this way, you can actually, because you're evolving the electric field, you can get parallel electric fields. So you can get an E dot B that's absent in ideal MHD, and that can in principle accelerate particles. You also have a test particle algorithm developed by Fabio Bacchini that can capture this effect, although I will not talk about it today. So how do we model reconnection in GRMHD? Actually, it's actually very simple. If you think about it, this is a Wikipedia image. You see like anti-parallel field here in the red and the blue, and the field will be sort of sucked into this reconnection layer, or we call it an X point. You can see why. And there is an accelerated outflow in the horizontal regions. And the question is, how large are we? We're pretty certain that these regions will form in the accretion disk, but how large are they and where do they form and can they power flex? So to make sure that our GRMHD algorithm captures this, we model this like current sheet or Harris sheet in a box and actually see that the global like dynamics are very similar to the particle and cell simulation. You can get this hierarchy of small to large plasmoids that merge and they form secondary current sheets here. So we sort of capture the physics pretty well. But we need this like small resistivity. And the reason for that, and I will not dive into the details or into the theory, but the reason for that is that there is a typical Lundquist number, or if you wish, a magnetic Reynolds number, that tells you the ratio between the advection timescales and the resistive timescales or diffusion timescales. And if that number is very small, if that number is very large, so that means a small resistivity, but not infinite, then it means that that such a current sheet is liable to the plasmoid instability. And that number is like theoretically determined to be 10 to the 4. And numerically, we actually confirmed that this is correct in these sort of local box experiments. So this means that your resistivity in dimensionless units here is smaller than 10 to the minus 4. So it And you have to believe me that induces very small spatial scales, which we have to capture with very high resolution. And I emphasize this particularly because we did a test of how high resolution we need. So this is a very simple test of an Orszag-Tang vortex. People using MHD codes will probably know this test. And here we set the resistivity such that this Lundquist number is above 10 to the 4. It's 20,000 here. And you see that the vortex sort of moves. And then indeed, it forms these current sheets. So these current sheets self-consistently form in a turbulent system. And if you look at the current density here, indeed, you see that it lights up. So there is a strong current here in these systems. And we did these simulations for increasing resolutions. And what you see is that if you look at the magnetic energy density evolution in the system, only at a resolution of 8,000 cells in this little box here, you see that the evolution converges if you compare it to the run with the doubled resolution, let's say. So this seems all very expensive. If you want to do a 3D simulation at say 16,000 cube, that's pretty much impossible for all of us, I think, at least running it for a full accretion disk simulation. But we have adaptive mesh refinement and we can actually refine it, particularly say on the current density, which we know is very strong. And here, I don't know if you can see the cells, but the cells really focus on this current sheet and on the plasmoid, whereas in the ambient, they're less resolved. So that's actually essential. It helps us a lot to capture these effects. So if you now add a resistivity to a typical accretion disk simulation, you see it here. You see the black hole here. In the top half, we're plotting the plasma beta, which is the ratio between magnetic energy density and gas pressure. Magnetic pressure and gas pressure. And in the bottom, I'm plotting this sigma parameter, which is magnetic energy density over Rasmus energy density. You will see that if we have a resistivity of 10 to the minus 14, which is absolutely unresolved on the grid, we get the same result as we know from ideal MHD. We get the magnetorotational instability developing turbulence in the disk. A jet here is launched through the Blandford-Znaik mechanism. But if we put this resistivity too high, and if you think of the Lundquist number as 1 over the resistivity, this would correspond to a Lundquist number of about 100, then you see that the turbulence is quenched and there is too much diffusion for reconnection to occur and even for turbulence to develop. So we need a small resistivity that's resolvable on the grid and that's small enough still for like the global dynamic we know from ideal MHD. And yeah, that's what we tried. So here you see an example of a 2D simulation. So this is axisymmetric. And I just, before I play the movie, I want to tell you, like the Lundquist number here is about 10 to the 5, and that's 1 over the resistivity. So we put the resistivity to 10 to the minus 5. We know we resolve it on the grid because we know the length scales involved. And the typical current sheet lengths here are about 1 Schwarzschild radius, and the typical speed is the speed of light. So then you can really calculate this Lundquist number to be of the order of 10 to the 5, which is an order of magnitude above the plasma limit. So if you now look at the movie here, you see the temperature, and here you see the plasma beta. You already see here in the still image that you get these current sheets that are looking a lot like the local box simulation. So you get these plasmoids here, and you see here that large blobs are emitted from these current sheets, and they also fall into the black hole. But more interestingly, you see that these plasmoids here close to the black hole actually get very warm. So this is a dimensionless temperature, or theta, as some people know it, call it, pressure over density. So if the temperature here is larger than one, it means that these structures are relativistic and that they will radiate. There is no radiation in the simulation, but we know that if they're relativistically hot, that they will radiate synchrotron radiation. So if I play the movie, here we go. You will see that these current sheets dynamically form, and there are really many of them in this standard and normal evolution, like SANE, as we call it. I see the video hangs a little bit, but I hope you can still see what's important. And as I said here on the left, you see that these structures that are emitted, for example, along the jet sheet and into the disk, they typically get very hot. So that's promising for a flare. Okay, I said most of this, like this simulation was at an effective resolution of about 12,000 by 6,000, but we were using these levels of mesh refinement to make sure that the outer regions where there's not a lot of dynamics, that they're not highly resolved. So we make sure that the current sheets particularly are captured by 10 cells over their widths, which is sort of a rule of thumb for resolving them. So if you zoom in, you indeed see that the resolution here is very high. And you see that indeed we capture these plasmoid mergers that will cause particle acceleration. And if we measure the typical like plasma diagnostics that we do in a local box, then we indeed see that the reconnection rate here is 0.01 of the Alphane speed, and this confirms that this is all completely in agreement with MHD theory. We also see that locally, if you go to locally flat frame, that this really looks like a current sheet. The magnetic field here goes through zero. There is no guide field. The current density peaks in the red line here. So it's all sort of as we know occurs in our local box simulation, just now self-consistently in the accretion disk simulation. So now the question is, like, can these things power flares? And you see here that these plasmoids have merged into this huge thing, which is indeed of the order of a Schwarzschild radius or even larger, that will orbit, or they will sort of helically move along the jet. So this picture here still seems in place, but the question is, can this power flare? And the answer is no. These plasmoids form in the inner 10 RG. That's all good. They have a lifetime of about 100 RG over C, which matches actually the flaring time scales for Sagittarius A star. Their maximum size, so they can grow to 1 RG and 100 RG over C, which confirms this reconnection rate of 0.01. So all the indicators are good. They're relativistically hot, but there is one issue. In a standard simulation, this happens all the time. So there is no distinction between when we have a flare and when we have like a quiescent period in this turbulent mass here. It's either constantly flaring or it's constantly quiescent. There is no distinction. So we cannot say that this really causes a flare. So for that reason, we went to this magnetically arrested disk, which actually is favored by the EHT observations of MD7 at least. And we did the same thing. So here you will see that the accretion is at some point really impeded. And when it's impeded, there is only a current sheet left. There is sort of a magnetosphere, just a very strong jet, and there is only a current sheet. And I'll just play the video. And you will see the same thing. The single current sheet gets very hot and it produces plasmoids. And those plasmoids are ejected if they don't fall into the black hole, if they can escape the gravitational pull. And they get very warm and they're emitted along the jet or into the disk. And this is a more promising mechanism for a flare. As you can see here, for example, these emitted hotspots. Here you see what happens. So like a flux tube sort of falls in, it forms a single current sheet, the current sheet becomes plasmoid unstable, and the plasmoids can merge into larger structures, monster plasmoids if you want, that can actually get injected. And this is still 2D. And here you see a clear distinction between a quiescent period where all of this plasma is cold, there are no plasmoids, there is no reconnection, it's just sort of a mildly turbulent accretion flow. until we get into a flaring state where you see that this whole actually jet boundary is warm, so it could even account for the limb brightening that we have observed. And you see that all the plasmoids that are not falling in, they're sort of being ejected from the reconnection exhaust into this like large hotspot. If you look at the temperature, actually, you see that this is a radial cut through this hotspot. You see that the temperature is really orders of magnitude larger if you translate it to Kelvin for Sagittarius A star units. And what you see additionally is that the magnetic field here, compared to the black line, which is the quiescence, where the field decays radially, you see that the field here is really small in these hotspot regions. And that's something particularly that gravity has actually observed, or that that has been observed for these flares, that the magnetic field has to drop. So this is a really promising mechanism. And now the question is actually, does this happen in 3D, in a real 3D simulation? Because one issue we still have here is that the flare indeed lasts for 30 to 60 minutes, which is in accordance with Sagittarius. But the time in between flares here is too short. It happens every 1 to 2 hours. And we think that is due to the 2D axis symmetry. Like this process of building up magnetic, I'm sorry about my dog, building up this magnetic flux that then suddenly decays, it happens continuously. And there is there are too many flares practically in 2D. You can see this here. This is the flux that builds up at the horizon. You see here, if you look, for example, at the blue line, you see that the flux decays at the horizon, it builds up, it decays again, and it decays again. And these are all flares, or they're practically just too many. This bottom one was the same, the more turbulent run, where actually you see that there are no such decays, and we're sort of constantly in a steady state. Very promising mechanism, but the flare, the time in between the flares is too short, which makes us think there is still something wrong, and we think that's due to 2D. So instead, we did a 3D simulation, and here you see the movie. I hope you can see it properly. But if you now actually look at, maybe I can play it again. Sorry, it's the wrong one. Let me play it again. If you pay attention to the red dot here, you see that the flux here in the bottom panel builds up. And the moment the flux decays here, you see that the current sheet forms. So actually, the mass accretion rate drops, and the magnetic flux that build up on the horizon drops at the same time. The mass accretion rate dropping makes is aligned with that the accretion disk here is ejected outwards, and we're only left with this current sheet, as I explained in 2D, and that the flux drops actually indicates that all this magnetic field is processed through reconnection and is transformed into kinetic energy. So if we zoom into this simulation, this is actually really high resolution 3D simulation. I indicated the orientation of the magnetic field here. So this is really a current sheet. And you see now that there are indeed these plasmoids, which look different in 3D because they have an extent into the screen practically here. And you see that, again, this magnetized magnetosphere forms here in between the horizon and the disk. So this is all practically jet. The disk is ejected over even like 10 Schwarzschild radii here. And this reconnection layer can actually power this episodic flaring state that I talked about before. And additionally, you also see that there are many little plasmoids, but there's also here, there's, for example, a larger structure, which is a result of mergers of these smaller guys. That is about 1 Schwarzschild radii. Here it's maybe a little bit smaller, but I have examples of where it really grows to 1 Schwarzschild radii. So if we're lucky, M87 might actually be observed by the EHT in such a flaring state once every few years, and maybe it might also explain the hotspot dynamics. I'll say a bit more about that later on. Resolving this plasmoid instability requires pretty extreme resolution. So this was a run at 5,000 by 2,500 by 2,500 cells, which was really only possible with the GPU code developed by Matthew Liska, the Hammer code. And I want to emphasize it was 1,000 times larger than typical EHT simulations. It cost more than 10 to the 6 GPU hours on Summit. So without a GPU acceleration, this really would not have been possible. So to guide your insight a little bit, this is what this looks like in 3D. So if you want to focus on the left bottom panel first, you see the quiescent state. And here there is no difference between green and blue field lines. They're all in the disk and they're all sort of nicely ordered. And you see that, again, I plot this dimensionless temperature here. All the temperature here is smaller than one, so there is no heating, there is no particle acceleration. But then we get into the flaring state, and you see that the blue field lines are now seated in the accretion disk, and they are pretty much like ordered here. And they only accrete onto this very narrow region here. So only very few of the blue lines fall onto the black hole. And this is because the accretion disk is ejected over a large extent of the azimuthal angle. In 2D, it's over the whole extent of the phi angle because it's 2D just by definition. And this actually shows why in 2D, the accretion is completely halted and why these flares actually occur too often, because every time the flux builds up, it's completely shut off. And this is sort of a continuous process. Whereas here, the accretion can still occur over a small angle until the reconnection has finished, and that takes a longer time. So these green field lines here are now the current sheet, and you see that this whole current sheet is hot. The whole temperature, everything here is at temperature larger than one. And if we zoom into, for example, here close to the horizon, we actually see that reconnection is occurring here. So you see these flux loops. The magenta one, it falls into the black hole. So these were actually two field lines that are connected. And the green flux loop can escape. And what you also see is that this field originally was horizontal, or it's actually like poloidal, but let's call it horizontal to make it easier. And due to the reconnection, it becomes vertical. So here you see that's only small vertical extent, but the further that this loop moves out, the more it gets stretched, and the more vertical this field gets. You also see these plasmoids here, the features that we saw in 2D that actually consist of little helical flux tubes in 3D that consist of these accelerated particles, which are not present in our simulation, but we know it from local PIC simulations. And again, here, this is zero guide field reconnection. There is no guide field. So it's the full magnetic field is really reconnecting and going through zero, both the toroidal and the radial. So again, you see that this current sheet becomes really hot. On the left, you see the equivalent picture that you saw in 2D before. And you see the temperature here again, the dimensionless temperature. And you see these plasmoids here, these big blobs, they get really hot and they get injected into the jet sheath, and they actually limb brighten the whole sheath. And if you look from the top, like a meridional view, you see that this whole thing here, this whole hot region, is actually the current sheet. And this should remind you of the 3D image that I showed before. The current sheet, however, is so thin that if you take a 2D slice, that it wiggles out of the plane here, as you see. I don't know if you can see my mouse, but it wiggles out of the plane here. And so this here is also part of the current sheet, just the hot region is just slightly out of the plane. And here, if you were to zoom in, you would see many reconnection sites where the field breaks and you get these escaping flux tubes. You see that, again, like the same mechanism applies as in 2D. The current sheet becomes relativistically hot. The time of a typical flare period is still 100 RG over C, but now the time in between flares is 1500 to 2000 RG over C, which indeed would correspond to one or two per day for Sagittarius A star. So the 3D, the non-axis symmetry that allows accretion over a small extent of the phi angle through Rayleigh Taylor instabilities, that actually saves the day for this flaring mechanism. However, that still doesn't teach us anything about the electron dynamics. We see that this flare can form, that reconnection plays a big role in heating the plasma and accelerating the particles, but there are no particles. So we still need particle and cell simulations of this phenomenon and rather of the global dynamics than just in a local box current sheet. But before I talk about that, I want to show you this video, which shows actually how the hotspot forms. So this is the temperature, and this is the same video as before. Just now I'm showing the temperature. Here the flare occurs, and if you focus on left, I will just play it again. This is the standard accretion, the standard magnetically arrested accretion. The funnel gets thinner and thinner, and here the disk is ejected, and you see this thin current sheet forms. It gets hot, and it emits all this hot plasma, these hot blobs, until they're gone. And now what you can see is that in the exhaust here, you actually see a vertical field, which initially is not there. It's all tangled field. But the exhaust from the layer, from the reconnection layer here, really outputs this vertical field that I've talked about before. But when it moves outwards, it gets stretched into this very large vertical column. If you now look on the right, you will see the same thing. So this is again the top view. And now you will see, once I play the video, that this hotspot is ejected and it orbits, and it consists exactly of this vertical field. So here you see the standard MAD accretion. Here the flare starts, or the reconnection starts. The hot material is ejected from the layer, and it starts to orbit here. And if you now draw a box, this is actually at the same location. So from the side view, you see that this field is really vertical, and from the top view, you actually see that this is a hot spot. It already cooled down a little bit. But this thing in reality will be fully filled with non-thermal particles, which you wouldn't even see in the GRMHD temperature as an exhaust from the reconnection. And why do we know that it will be filled with non-thermal particles? Because we modeled for years already these type of current sheets in particle and cell, where you actually evolve these particles. And you see that reconnection at in these magnetized environments, because the layer is really fed by the material of the jet, which is highly magnetized, you will see that it strongly accelerates particles that create power loss. So what about these kinetic physics? Can we probe them actually? Can we zoom into this region here, model this current sheet at the black hole and not just in a local box, and leave out the accretion, because it's extremely hard to model accretion in particle and cell, or even impossible up to now. Can we model like just this current sheet? That was a question we had. So we did a resistive GRMHD simulation where we put a dipole field onto a black hole. And through the no-hair theorem, actually the black hole sheds this field. This is a whole other topic, which is more applicable to black hole neutron star mergers or collapsing stars. But I just want you to focus on the result, which is a split monopole where you get a current sheet. And that current sheet looks exactly the same as the one I saw in the global 3D simulations. So this is still transient. And here at some point here, you see the current sheet forming. And you see indeed plasmoids can fall into the black hole, but the escaping ones, they can merge and they can grow into these larger structures, which are about 1 RG. And they move outward. So here is no disk. So this is sort of a continuous process until all the field is depleted. But we can see if the same thing happens in a particle and cell simulation. So we took the general relativistic particle and cell code of Sasha Filipov and Benoit Cerutti and Karl Parfrey, and we modeled the same thing. I don't have a video, unfortunately. But if you put a little imagination, you will see that exactly the same dynamics are going on, except that here these typical plasmoids are like this size, whereas here they are a lot larger, and they really are larger than the black hole. So, and in both cases, this is very well resolved. For the MHD, we again use mesh refinement to make sure that we resolve the Lundquist number. And for particle and cell, you can do a similar convergence study to make sure that you resolve the skin depth, etc. Not go into those details. But what we know is that collisionless reconnection, so in a particle and cell code, is 10 times faster. So it's not 0.01 alpha in speed or 0.01 speed of light, but it's 0.1. So it's 10% of the speed of light, which is a collisionless effect. It's due to the anisotropic pressure. So all details that I will skip, but I'll happily explain if you have questions. But it in practice, it means that larger hotspots can grow in a shorter time. So this will really affect your either your flare duration or period, or the size of these hotspots that can go 10 times larger in the same period of time. Additionally, GRPIC also evolves the distribution function. So from first principles, you actually know the electron dynamics and temperature of this collisionless pair plasma. So what we did to make sure that all of this is sort of in agreement, we modeled we call it the balding black hole, because the magnetic field is shedding to keep the black hole bald and to adhere to the no-hair conjecture. Model this balding black hole in 3D in with resistive MHD. And then you see a very similar thing as in the global simulations. You see this sort of this spiraling current sheet, and again you see the X points and the plasmoids. But you can literally compare these two simulations, particle and cell and MHD, and tweak your resistivity so that it's non-uniform. And you can increase the reconnection rate to be similar to the kinetic one. This is a process that we're currently going through, and it's not as easy as it sounds maybe, but we have confidence that we can capture truly kinetic effects in the reconnection process in the global MHD simulation, and in that way really fully explain the flare duration and period. If you look here, for example, at the comparison between the two, here you see the reconnection rate. So this is the current sheet here, and you see that the inflow into the sheet here is indeed at 10% of the speed of light in the PIC simulation, and at 1% of the speed of light in MHD simulation. And if you actually look at the flux decay that I talked about before, like the flux that accumulates at the horizon, then what was very surprising to us is that in this sort of toy problem where you just put a current sheet in front, like at the horizon, the flux decay actually follows this exponential decay of e to the minus t over 500. And I didn't show you this before, but this is exactly the same coefficient, exactly the same exponential decay as we saw in the global 3D accretion disk section. So this is a generic process that reconnection just does. Reconnection can make the flux decay at exactly this rate of t over 500. And this is remarkable because we didn't put this in or something. This is just a result of this universal reconnection rate in the plasmoid-dominated regime. So now you would say if you do a particle and cell simulation, this has to happen faster because your reconnection rate is 10 times faster. So you would maybe expect a minus t over 50. Well, it's close. It's minus t over 150. So there are global effects that actually sort of not make this an exact factor 10. But you can see that indeed in particle and cell, this flux decays about 3 to 4 times faster. And this is a direct result of this faster reconnection rate. So my conclusion is that we can capture reconnection on the global scales with resistive or even ideal GRMHD if there is a small enough numerical resistivity or high enough resolution. You need to resolve these scales. Reconnection is 10 times faster in GRPIC, but with GRMHD, you're already doing a pretty good explaining the flare mechanism. But in GRPIC, we either expect faster flares or larger hotspots or a combination of both. But GRPIC will also tell us actually the actual magnetization composition of the plasma. It will tell us what the radiation does because we can evolve photons, and it will have the right reconnection rate. And then we hope to extract from that a resistivity model, a non-uniform resistivity model that we can put into the GRMHD. And in that way, we hope to actually develop an algorithm that captures some of the kinetic physics that's necessary to explain both the global dynamics and the flare properties. And that way we hope to explain and predict, for example, new generation EHT results and gravity observations. I think that was everything. Yeah, that was everything. Thanks a lot for listening.
Thanks so much, Bart, for this wonderful talk. Quite a fireworks of really beautiful results and thoughts on reconnection. Are there any questions? Okay, I think Juan had his hand up first.
Thanks, very nice talk. Yeah, I have a question. Maybe you already explained it, but does this GRPIC simulation also predict the time separation between the flare state and the...
This one does not. This is the way we modeled it, because there's a current sheet at all times. It's sort of constantly in the flaring state. So this one does not predict the time separation in between the flares. It only predicts the time scale of the flare itself. So this 100 RG over C or something. However, we currently have, but I didn't show them today, we have accreting simulations of the GRPIC in the GRPIC code. Which we really only managed to do this month, so I didn't dare showing it yet, but they actually show also the time in between flares. So yeah, I would say stay tuned. I hope to tell you soon.
Okay, thanks.
Can you Can I just quickly jump on this, because I had a very similar question as Juan. So you mentioned this this longer timescale you get in the 3D resistive simulations between individual flares. So is this I don't remember, was it 1,500 RG or something over C? Is it understood like what the physical reason for this timescale is? I mean, I appreciate you find that in the simulation, and, you know, you see the sort of the buildup of these plasmoids and everything, but is there sort of a basic physical argument to understand that timescale?
Yeah, that's a great question. I sort of didn't explain that because I was running out of time. The idea is that the flare property, so this 100 RG over C is really the reconnection rate. I think that's pretty clear. But sort of the global accretion dynamic sets the time in between flares. And that's practically the viscous time on which all this flux can build up until a steady state. And once it reached a steady state, then it will have to decay. And the reason for that is because it reached its sort of equipartition between magnetic energy and like gravitational potential. So like the magnetic energy that sort of builds up becomes equal to the gravitational potential. The black hole cannot fit more, so to say. Well, this sounds very wrong to gravitational people, but I'm just going to still use it. So the magnetic field builds up sort of in front of the black hole and impedes the accretion. And all of that happens on a viscous timescale, and it actually goes through Rayleigh-Taylor instabilities. And during the steady state, there are many really azimuthal Rayleigh-Taylor modes that bring in the accretion. And at some point, this switches to one single low M like azimuthal Rayleigh-Taylor mode, and then the current sheet forms. So we sort of understand this has to be the viscous timescale. It's a global dynamics to Rayleigh-Taylor, but why the Rayleigh-Taylor switches from many modes to suddenly one mode, that we don't understand yet. So we're thinking of doing a local Rayleigh-Taylor simulations that sort of mimic this process to understand it a bit better. But that's still hard to understand. So partially, yes, we understand it. Global dynamics, viscous timescales. Partially, no, we don't understand why the Rayleigh-Taylor suddenly changes in terms of modes.
Cool. Very interesting. Okay, I think next was Aman, I think.
Hi, hello. Great talk. I had one question from the start, like when you motivated from the observations that in one of the system, the observations were in the X-ray regime, and in the other, it was in the gamma ray regime. Right. So this mechanism, plasmoid mechanism, can explain both of them. Is it understood like why the two systems have although they are side by side in the EM spectrum, but why it's separate, like different? One is in the gamma. Is it some reprocessing of the signal that's happening?
This is a great question. Yeah, I didn't go into details at all, but they're in the paper that will hopefully come out soon in detail. So the difference is practically just the regime of where the plasma is in. So both these jets are highly magnetized. But their typical scales are very different. The mass scales are different of these black holes. So the ratio between particle Larmor radius and the large scale is different. And what happens is that in M87, a particle is sucked into the reconnection layer, accelerates. And the moment it accelerates to high energies due to reconnection, it immediately loses all its radiation. So it's extremely radiatively efficient, but that radiation has such energies that it will actually start to interact with the background photons that are already there, like KeV photons or lower, start to pair produce, and inverse Compton scattering becomes important, and that will actually give you the TeV signal. So it's really complicated radiation physics in the M87. So first you have synchrotron losses. Due to the reconnection, like as an immediate, like the particles immediately synchrotron radiate everything. And then the interaction of that radiation with sort of the background photons that gives you pair production, and that results in a TeV signal. That's something that we sort of estimated because this doesn't follow from MHD simulations. They're all dimensionless, but you can probe it with particle and cell simulations. We're working on that. For Sagittarius, however, first of all, I have to say for Sagittarius, we don't know if there is a jet, and if there is a jet, exactly how it's oriented. But if you mm-hmm. were to assume that there is also a magnetized region like the jet, which is almost certainly there, what happens for Sagittarius parameters is the particle synchrotron radiate, and that synchrotron radiation itself will be in the X-ray or the near-infrared band. And the whole secondary part of the pair production is way less important. I'm not saying there is no pair production, it's just less dominant. And it's actually pretty acute because you can estimate this purely on known and observed parameters like the magnetic field for these two systems. So it's a pretty neat like back of the envelope estimate. If you're interested, like you can do it yourself on one page of paper.
Ah, okay. Thank you. And just one more question. So I might have missed that link, but you said that you're using the existence of turbulence to constrain your resistivity, right? For the higher range. So this turbulence, so in this whole plasmoid phenomena, the turbulence is, I think, required for the whole phenomena. That's why you are using that to constrain the resistivity. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's actually less complicated than that. Ideally, you would do that. Ideally, you would have a resistivity, a viscosity, a heat conductivity. You would have all of that, but it's very hard to model that in GR because these are all effects that... my dog thinks it's time to finish. If you don't do this very carefully, all these effects will be acausal, like viscosity will give you an acausal effect. So I didn't take all of that into account. We are working on that. Elias Most is working on that, for example. But here, the only motivation for having a small resistivity below 10 to the minus 4 typically is that you want a magnetic Reynolds number that's larger than 10 to the 4. And this we know from analytics and also from local box plasma simulations. If you have a Lundquist or magnetic Reynolds number that's above 10 to the 4, current sheets become thin enough to become plasmoid unstable. And if not, mm-hmm. There is actually more diffusion going on and not reconnection. So my only goal was to put a resistivity that's small enough to give you 10 to the 4 number, but large enough so mm-hmm. that it could still resolve it on the grid. That's the whole, it's as simple as that.
Okay,
I think Ginny was next.
Hi Bart, thanks for the nice talk. Yeah, so speaking about the resistivity, so I'm just wondering how would your resistive MHD results depend on this one, on the resistivity? And another thing is that in some cases, for example, in the non-retrovisor reconnection, people say that there will be some turbulent-induced anomalous resistivity that you can enhance the reconnection rate in some sense, right? So I would like to know what kind of result you would say conclusion you draw can be robust and what stays kind of not that robust. Yeah.
Yeah, that's also a great question. Both the things you say are true, and but they're two separate aspects. Like the current sheet that we're focusing on now is the one that really lives sort of inside the jet. So the surrounding plasma is not turbulent during this flare episode. Let's say the surrounding plasma is not turbulent. It's just the jet that is at extremely high magnetization. So this really looks like a standard Harris sheet. So, and in a 3D Harris sheet can indeed become locally turbulent, which you also see here, for example, like there is turbulence locally here in the sheet, but it's not like this global turbulence here. So if you would just focus on this sheet here, then it's really like a Harris sheet in a box. And then we know that all we need is a resistivity, or rather a resolution that's high enough to allow these plasma unstable current sheets to form and to do their thing. If, however, you want to look at turbulent reconnection, for example, what would go on here in the disk, something that I showed in 2D a little bit like earlier on, you have all sorts of interplay between the turbulence and the reconnection, and then resistivity in itself is in principle not enough. So then you would get an interplay of like analytically, people think at a Reynolds number of about 10 to the 6, you get an effect of the reconnection on your turbulent cascade. So there will be an extra break in your turbulent cascade, and that can result into particle acceleration. That's something that's completely unexplored currently. There are only very few simulations that explore this regime, and they are just at the limit of reaching these Lorentz factors, just because we cannot reach those solutions. So it's very hard to say something, but it would be extremely interesting to probe this, actually. This is also why I'm saying it would be very interesting to have resistivity models that are better than a simple uniform and constant thing. Just at the moment, that's the best we can do. And before you plug in a resistivity model that takes other effects into account, you want to sort of robustly compare it with particle and cell simulations and see like where it comes from. You're definitely right, but it's at the moment it's too hard, both because the model doesn't exist and because it's too hard to resolve those scales where the turbulence and the reconnection start to interact. People are just doing this in local simulations at the moment.
Sure, thanks.
Okay, and I think then Michael was next. Michael, I think you're muted.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, that's better. Thanks.
Okay, good. Thanks for the great talk. It was very interesting. So towards the end, you mentioned these neural simulations, which also include the particle in a cell methods, and that those were more relevant for the micro-neutron star merger scenarios or merger scenarios in general. So I was wondering if you expect this similar MET type accretion also in those scenarios, because beforehand for the larger black holes, you motivated it from the event horizon, polarization pictures and the flares. But for such smaller merger systems, I was wondering if you can expect the same thing to occur.
Yeah, great question. I think maybe Daniel knows this better than I, but I think we don't really know if they are mad or not. I think they can be. I mean, to me, but this is an opinion and not like a scientific fact, but to me, it seems much more likely that a disk becomes mad than that it stays turbulent. I cannot give you an answer. The reason I said this was more relevant for neutron star black hole mergers is because this is a very simple toy model of what happens when a black hole swallows a neutron star, or if a large star with a dipolar magnetic field collapses to a black hole. Because then initially, so here there are no accretion physics involved at all. There is no disk whatsoever. But initially, that black hole will have a dipolar field. That's what you see in the video here. So here you see a dipolar field, and it's shed off by the black hole. So what we thought was like, because we don't have a GRP code that does space-time dynamics, we thought to just take a black hole, put a dipolar field on it, and see what happens. And it turns out that the dipolar field is shed off on an exponential timescale that is strongly related to the reconnection rate, to the fast plasmoid-dominated reconnection rate. And that sort of told us that the no-hair theorem is satisfied also in a black hole that's encapsulated in plasma. After a merger has occurred. Then the interesting thing is that if this indeed happens and such a current sheet forms in such a system, it might give you some sort of precursor electromagnetic emission to the merger or to the collapse. But this is not at all my specialty. So this is, I'm speculating a little bit here.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And then I had another question. So in the beginning, you mentioned that when these plasmoids form, they depending on where they form, they can either go out or they are swallowed by the black hole. And you also mentioned that there even is a possibility of them being ejected from the disk. So I was wondering, is this also something that you see in your simulations?
Yeah, and we actually see them. I don't know if I can quickly find, maybe this one here. I clicked too fast, I'm sorry. Anyway, you see that these plasmoids, they if they form inside the ergosphere, they typically fall in. They can still escape, but usually the pull is too strong inside the ergosphere, so they cannot escape unless they merge. And due to the merger, they get a little bit of like outgoing velocity. But the plasmoids that can escape, what happens in this in the mat type accretion is that they bump into the disk, but the field here is still strong. So the plasmoids themselves, they don't go into the disk. They typically move along that and they heat the jet here. And that is sort of like a helical movement, if you imagine in 3D. But those larger things, which we call hotspots, which are actually like these elongated flux tubes, which are the results of many plasmoid mergers sort of, but they're not plasmoids anymore themselves. Those flux tubes, they can impede the disk and then start to orbit in the disk before they diffuse. And their diffusion goes again through Rayleigh-Taylor instabilities, and they sort of spread all the non-thermal particles into the disk. So there are two effects. One is like the smaller structures will sort of move helically along the jet, and we call that ejected. I don't know if it's the right word because they're not really leaving here, but like they move along the jet sheath and they heat it. And the second effect is like this big flux tube that sort of keeps moving in the disk until it diffuses.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Okay, any more questions?
If no one has, like, I can ask one more.
Okay, Aman, go ahead.
Just one thing, since you were discussing about the sheet and the heating, what is the most, the dominant heating mechanism in these sheets?
How exactly do you mean? Like, between what do you want me to distinguish?
I'm just wondering whether it's like the turbulence heating or some magnetic energy being converted into
heat. Yeah, the second. It's the magnetic energy. So the reconnection really takes, the reconnection is really efficient here because this jet region here is so strongly magnetized. In real life, it's about 10 to the 9 magnetization. Here it's at the floor, so it's like 100. So the magnetic energy here is transformed into kinetic energy in the reconnection layer. So it sucks floored plasma into the current sheet. Then it's not floored anymore; it becomes dynamic because the sigma goes lower, and then that plasma here gets accelerated because the magnetic energy is sort of transformed to the particle's kinetic energy. So it's a really magnetic. Yeah, magnetic energy that's being transformed. There is probably also some turbulent heating, but it's probably not super relevant here, but more relevant further in the disk.
Okay, yeah. Thank you.
Okay, maybe can I drill in on one of the previous questions a little more regarding the resistivity model, essentially. So you were mentioning that, you know, you're about to think about this, and I appreciate that, you know, things are in flux, but I was just curious to hear your thoughts on how you actually go, you know, practically about this with your, I guess, your GRP code and everything.
Yeah, so what we're doing at the moment, and I'm also hoping that this paper will come out soon. We have a student in Amsterdam, Sebastian Selvi, who is running like just local box Harris sheet simulations, both in PIC and in resistive MHD. And in resistive MHD, he's doing both a uniform resistivity, like we do in these simulations, and a non-uniform, like PIC-based model for the resistivity. And what you can do, and what people have typically also thought about, is to make your resistivity proportional to the current density, because like the current density is strong in the current sheet, so you only get resistivity there, and the rest of your plasma is typically ideal, which is correct. Like in the upstream, this plasma doesn't do reconnection. So if your resistivity is locally enhanced, that actually typically increases your reconnection rate. And the reason for that is that your reconnection rate goes up for smaller Lundquist numbers. So for higher resistivities, your reconnection rate goes up. But if your Lundquist number is globally small, like 100 or something, that like reconnection rate is the square root of the Lundquist number, the inverse square root of the Lundquist number. So a Lundquist number of 100 would give you a reconnection rate of 0.1. So you'd say problem solved. But that's not correct, because what it would do, it would just diffuse everything. There would be no reconnection. So you only want locally in the current sheet, you want a Lundquist number of say 100, but in the ambient, you want a Lundquist number that's infinite or very large. And that you can model. And then Pick simulation, if you just plot, say, the ratio of the electric field over the current density, that is your Ohm's law in MHD, that will give you resistivity. And what I really like about the student's work is that you see that this resistivity is really only non-zero in an X point in a current sheet. So not even in the whole current sheet, but literally only where the reconnection happens. So really only where the field line does this. And if you think about where that happens in MHD, you can, for example, your current density will peak there, but also the divergence of the velocity field will peak there. So you can sort of really, based on the divergence of V and the curl of B, you can really focus your resistivity only to be present in such an X point. And if you do that, you actually see in local box Harris simulations that your reconnection rate goes to 0.1 while you still get plasmoids. So there is no diffusion, and the reconnection rate only depends really on this value in this X point where the reconnection really occurs. Now, you can imagine this is quite cumbersome. This is not like you don't just plug it into global simulation and it works, of course, because, well, you know how turbulent these things typically are. So getting it to work in a global simulation will require a lot of work, and we will first try it for simplified systems, maybe this Balding black hole. But eventually, I hope we will get there to do it in 3D accretion disk simulation.
Yeah. But just want to ask, if this resistivity emerges where the MHD condition is broken, so you have E larger than B somewhere or not?
Yeah, but in resistive MHD, that's not a problem.
Yeah, sure. But yeah. In PIG, is it something like you have a large resistivity just because, like, in the X point, you accelerate the particles in? Okay.
Exactly. Yeah, you get E larger than B exactly there. And it's really neat if you plot, like, E larger than B or E over B and E dot B, you see that, well, E dot B, depending on if you have a guide field or not, you really see that this, and also in MHD, these values are only non-zero really in the X points. And that aligns perfectly with PIC. But it also makes it equally hard to resolve these things in MHD. So, you know, there is still no free lunch, unfortunately. But we have
maybe
AMR
one.
In MHD.
Yeah, sorry.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, maybe one last question from my side, at least. Going back to the beginning of your talk, I was wondering. So you were mentioning these flare observations, and that sort of the centroid motion that was detected is sort of taken as evidence for plasmoid formation. So what's the interpretation and connection here that sort of links these two phenomena?
People have always thought that it was maybe a plasmoid already, like maybe 5-6 years ago, they thought that a plasmoid could orbit. And then in 2018, gravity observed this orbiting hotspot. And initially people thought it might be a plasmoid, but it turns out plasmoids themselves are too small and also don't in themselves go into orbit. So I don't think anymore that it's a plasmoid. Sorry. I think it's rather the exhaust of the reconnection layer that forms this flux tube here. And if you really focus on this region, like you see now the current sheet sort of forming, and these little plasmoids, you know, they're not observable. But this whole exhaust thing here, this hot thing, which is now moving outwards and now is like being stretched into this vertical field, this is what gives you the hotspot. And here you see that it's indeed really hot, and it's not even hot in terms of MHD temperature. It's like still close to TS1, but it will be completely filled with non-thermal particles, which are strongly radiating. And you see it's pretty confined because the field is so coherent there. So this will really exist for like one orbit, as you could also see in the right video. See if it plays or if it's too heavy. I clicked twice, I'm sorry. The question is, of course, like, what happens if you model this in PIC and you actually see what the non-thermal particles do? Are they radiating? Are they diffusing out too quickly? I don't know yet, but the mechanism is very promising that you get a coherent blob that's filled with the non-thermal particles that were initially in the plasmoids. That sort of goes in orbit at about 10 RG radius. I mean, it follows self-consistently and just too reminiscent of what gravity observed.
Yeah, I agree. That's pretty convincing. Thanks. Maybe one last technical question I stumbled across. When you were talking about the convergence of the resistive simulations. So since you mentioned that these plasmoid formations are a scale invariant process, so I was wondering how to understand convergence of these simulations, or I don't exactly remember which quantity you were plotting there, but yeah, so I was just trying to understand what convergence in that case means in the presence of a scale invariant process.
That's a good question. So I think what I mean with convergence is it really depends on what you look at. Like, because I have no viscosity, actually my turbulence will always be unconverged, right? I mean, if I add another level, my cascade will just elongate, my inertial range will get longer and longer until it hits the grid again. But with reconnection, there are two aspects. One is that you want to be in this asymptotic plasmoid dominated regime. So this means that you have to resolve on the grid a Lundquist number of 10 to the 4, which just literally gives you a length scale. So that's one. And that translates to the rule of thumb that you want about 10 cells along your current sheet thickness. You can really calculate, because you know you're in this asymptotic regime, your reconnection rate is 0.01. And your reconnection rate, you can transform to the ratio between the length and the thickness of the sheet. It's just a conservation law, like if you deem it all incompressible. So you know sort of your length scale, if your current sheet is 1 RG or whatever, then the thickness has to be like a percent of that. And then you know how many cells you need to resolve that thickness with, say, 10 cells. And 10 cells is then enough to converge it. So that's one aspect. The second aspect is if you look at the evolution of the magnetic energy density or the electric energy density for that matter, which are the two things that matter for reconnection, because you produce a parallel electric field and you convert magnetic field. You want that not to sort of differ anymore if you increase your resolution. But what does differ mean? You know, do you then require 10%, 1% or whatever? So that self-similar process of a reconnection layer in between two merging plasmoids, which then will become plasmoid unstable and again will have a reconnection layer, you can in principle never resolve, because it's a never-ending process, especially in MHD, where this is all not limited by any scale. So that part you will never converge. But what I mean with convergence is that you want to converge the initial plasmoid instability and the thickness of the initial current sheet that becomes plasmoid unstable. And that we make sure. In PIC, there are, of course, skin depth sizes involved that you need to resolve. And if you don't resolve that, your simulation typically just does very bad stuff. So there it's harder to converge, but it's easier to understand what it means, because there are real dimensions.
Great. Yeah. Thanks. Okay. Any other final thoughts or questions? Comments? Okay, well, I think I could continue asking you questions for hours, but I think we have to come to a conclusion at some point, and we should let you go. It seems also that your dog is eagerly awaiting your attention.
He's quiet again now.
say hello to him.
I will.
And we'll have to stop here. And thank you so much again, Bart. That was really a fantastic talk and discussion. Much appreciated.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Thanks for all the great questions. It's really nice to interact. And if there's anything that you want to ask, just email me or Daniel. Like, we can chat another time. Or anyone. Like, just send me an email, and we can chat more.
Yeah, sounds great, Bart. We should catch up at some point. I unfortunately actually also have to go now to another meeting. But we should catch up in the next couple of weeks or so.
Let's do that.
Sounds good. Okay. Well, thanks everyone for attending, and see you all next week. Bye, everyone.
Thanks, everyone. Bye bye.
Thank you.